Hi, I'm Andy Finn, and I am begging you to listen to my show at www.andyfinn.us.
The Andy Finn Show, Uncommon Talk Radio.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and today is the 14th of April. Not only the day that President Lincoln was shot, but it was the day that James Cashpenny opened his first store in Wyoming. Of all places, James Cash being J.C. Penny, and they called it at the time the Golden Rule Store, which is interesting, instead of J.C. Penny's. And I guess the Golden Rule Store is that whoever has the gold makes the rules, as I recall. And it was also the day, oh, by the way, I'm sorry, that was 1902, so it's 106 years since J.C. Penny opened his store. And it's also the day that Noah Webster published his dictionary, the first edition of Webster's Dictionary, which wasn't called Webster's at the time, in the same way J.C. Penney's wasn't called J.C. Penney's at the time. And it wasn't called the Golden Rule Dictionary. No, it was called the American Dictionary of the English Language. So guess what year? Think about this. What year would be the year that Noah Webster? A lot of you would be in the right range, I think. 1828 was the year of Noah's dictionary. In any case, let's talk a couple of issues in sports. And this is hardly sports in a way, but I thought this issue was pretty funny. The New York Yankees are considering a lawsuit against a construction worker who's working on the new Yankee Stadium. Get this. The team found out that this worker buried a jersey from the Boston Red Sox in the cement under a locker room in the new Yankee Stadium. Now, this stadium will open a year from now, and it's right across the street from the current Yankee Stadium. This is the last season in the old Yankee Stadium, the house that Ruth built. If you want to have one more visit to Yankee Stadium, and if you've never been to Yankee Stadium, I don't care if you're a baseball fan or not, it's worth going to. It's one of the more distinctive parks in the country in terms of its shape, always has been, and it's got more history than any arena or stadium in the country. And they're going to tear it down at the end of the year, and the Yankees are going to play in a new stadium. Skyboxes, here we come. But anyway, they figured out that this construction worker who roots for the Red Sox had buried this shirt based on a report that the New York Post did on Friday. Somehow they got a hold of it last Friday. And so they were going to leave it, and then they thought, no, you know something, we're going to dig it up. So they figured out where it was. They spent 5 hours jackhammering, digging, drilling through cement, and they found it. They dug it up. It was a David Ortiz shirt. They dug it out and took it out. So I just thought that was hilarious, actually. By the way, the whole purpose of this was that the idea was the Red Sox fan thought he would put a curse on the new stadium by burying a Red Sox jersey there. Yeah, I think that's how it works, but I'm just not sure. The other sports topic worth mentioning briefly is that Trevor Immelman, who is a golfer you've probably never heard of if you didn't watch the Masters yesterday or follow golf to some extent, won the Masters yesterday in Augusta. Now, every April, the first of the four golf majors takes place. And I guess I only want to say a couple of things about this because I know that a lot of you are not sports fans. The first is that I love the Masters and I love the major golf tournaments. Tiger Woods has set some amazing records at the Masters. And he's on such a hot streak. You know, he had won, I don't know, 7 of 8 tournaments. No one does that. That's like tennis. People might win 7 of 8 tournaments in a row because you can eliminate your opponents. In golf, you can't play defense, so anyone can jump up and have a better round than you. No one wins 7 out of 8 tournaments. Jack Nicklaus in his best day might win 5 in a season. You know, now Tiger's done that multiple times, but the idea you could win every tournament you enter or most every tournament you enter is absurd. He's so much in a class by himself that it used to irritate me when they talked Tiger, 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 even when he wasn't in first place. Now I accept it because he's not just because he's the star, and that's what they do with stars in the newspaper, is they sell more papers when they talk about the biggest name, even when he's not the top player that week. But Tiger is so far ahead of the rest of the field at his best that I understand the nature of the coverage. Having said that, it was interesting how they dealt with it again this week. Trevor Immelman had a commanding lead most of Saturday and Sunday, most of Sunday. And while he lost a couple of strokes, so did everybody else just about. And yet they talked about, oh, Tiger's only 5 back. He's looming. At five back, you're looming. It's true that he could make a move and anything could happen, but it's almost as though the announcers were, you know, they wanted him to collapse and they wanted Woods to do better. And, of course, Immelman was the guy who was rock solid all day and made the putts, made the shots he needed to get near the hole, avoid the water, avoid the trouble, and made the putts on the green when he needed to. So he was the champion, and they could have commented all afternoon long on Sunday that how on top of his game was, how fearless he was, how unrattled he was. And yet, they didn't choose that narrative, of course. If Tiger had been in the lead, making shot after shot, they would have used that narrative. Instead, they were hoping that Tiger would get closer. And that's just the way it is, you know, when you see, the favorite in the NCAA tournament or the team that's heavily favored in any given game, the narrative is always, oh, you better not let this one get away if you're the team that's not favored. But if you get an 8, 10, even a 30, 20-point lead in basketball, they'll say, well, you better watch out because this team can come back. That's just the way they are in sports. The other thing that kind of bugs me about sports that I don't talk about too much, but I've been thinking lately about what it is to be what life is like for sports writers. And I don't know if you even read the sports section. I don't read it very thoroughly. But one of the things I've noticed over the years, and I used to write a little bit of sports, as some of you out there may know. I used to do a little bit of writing for the Village Voice. They don't have much of a sports page, but I wrote a few items for them way back in the late 80s. And in the late 80s, I also wrote a couple of essays for the Baseball Abstract. What had been Bill James's Baseball Abstract was continued for a year under the same name without his authorship. And then he retired completely from it, and he decided not to offer it to other people. Now, Bill James was just featured on 60 Minutes last week as the guy that helped the Red Sox win the pennant. He is the creator of sabermetrics. Not only the term sabermetrics, the study of baseball performance, that means mostly baseball statistics, but he was the first guy to do it and the best at it. Anyway, what I noticed about sports writers in looking over the paper over the last few years is, you know, you couldn't pay me these days to be a sports writer. It is true that if you love sports or like them, it allows you to focus on your favorite hobby. And in fact, get good. If you're a top-notch reporter, you get good seats for major events. You could sit courtside at the NCAA Finals. You ever noticed at the NCAA Finals they had three rows of press on each side? It might have six rows of press altogether. I forget exactly, but they got hundreds of people there with primo seats down front because they're sports writers. It's the coolest gig in the world. The problem is that aside from reporting facts and doing the play-by-play, the game stuff, the other thing is editorializing. The problem with editorializing in sports is you could make predictions if you want, like who's going to win a particular tournament or game, or you can philosophize about why a team's doing well or not doing well. The other thing they do, and this is what they spend a lot of their time doing, is coming up with metaphors, coming up with imagery to describe how things go. And so they get very flowery. They get very, not nostalgic, they get very emotional. They try and pull at your heartstrings. And I have to tell you that it's one of the strangest forms of writing because there's nothing equivalent in the real news business. In other words, you may not have thought of this before, but the sports section's an interesting section. There is an entertainment section, typically a style section to a newspaper, but they don't report entertainment as news. Oh, they might report on a concert that took place at the Verizon Center if it's big enough when Miley Cyrus came to town, or the Rolling Stones come to town, or some big-name rapper come to town, or Madonna, or whatever. But in general, you get a review of the performance, but it isn't treated as... the performance itself is not treated as news. In sports, because we don't know the outcome, the performance itself is treated as news. And so when you pick up the sports page, there's editorials, like there are in the A section of the newspaper, on the editorial page, and there are news items. There are the outcomes of games and the reports on the outcomes of games treated as news articles. It's just not like that in the rest of the entertainment field. Sports is an entertainment business, and they've convinced the country that what they do is news because you don't know who's going to win. You know on the 582nd performance of a particular play, Cats or any theater production, you know how it's going to go. You don't know exactly how it's going to go, but you know what the plot is. You know what the ending's going to be. You don't know how good the performance is, but sports gives us a quantitative measure of who won and who lost, and that's why I guess we treat it as news. But back to editorials, what's interesting is there's a lot of people, sports writers, that graduate from writing the play-by-play, the articles on what happened last night in sports, to commentary. And sports commentary is so much blather for me. I don't spend much time with it anymore. And I guess the main reason is that it's not like commentary in the editorial page in the opinion section of the A section of the newspaper. There, people are talking about Iraq, they're talking about world events, they're talking about the subprime crisis, they're talking about the election. And while a lot of it's blather, that is, a ultra-conservative or an ultra-liberal is just hacking their point of view, and they're ignoring the other side of things, at least it's something substantive that matters in life, typically. Whereas in sports, since sports doesn't matter, they resort to all kinds of metaphors about, you know, how tall he's standing and how what he faced and the courage it took, and all of that rhetoric is just pretty interesting. And so I thought of it again this week as I was reading a few of these articles. Let's see if I can wrap this up. So the prostitution trial is ongoing on the D.C. madam, and the bottom line is she's in trouble. And the reason she's in trouble is that the D.C. madam is now, there's a parade of witnesses, people who paid for sex, men who paid for sex, and women who gave sex. Now, she's maintained all along that it was just a fantasy thing, and if there was any sex involved, she's shocked, and she didn't know that there was gambling going on at Rick's. But they come on, and they've embarrassed all these women, including a 63-year-old woman who is she's spent 7 years as a call girl for the D.C. madam, and she has a Ph.D., and she's 63 now, and I guess guys were paying her for sex. I just find that interesting. Maybe she chews the fat with them. I don't get it. Moving on to one other topic, team building or torture. So there's a company called out in Provo, Utah, that waterboarded one of their, what do we call them, associates in a team building exercise. It's a high pressure sales force, a telephone sales deal. And they waterboarded this one guy to show how you should fight for, just like you fight for air, you should fight for sales. And he's suing them now, saying, I was tortured. And so the question is, the court will have to decide, was this team building or was this torture? I know those of you who've been to ropes courses, those of you who have been to team building all day deals, you would say all team building is torture. I know, I know. Anyway, with that in mind, we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, we are going to talk about Barack Obama and the bitter controversy that's arisen about his comments that people in rural Pennsylvania are bitter after years of being neglected by both parties and multiple administrations. And so let's move on to bitter with a little bit of angry people.
Richard B. Cheney swears that Pat lay in public like so much hot air. Insists he and Bush care, waits for the weapons, still thinks Iraq was a threat to the U.S. homeland. I can't understand all the Bush appointees. Where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong? Rabbit and Coulter writing the words to a book that reflects a strange fear. Who would come near, look at her whining, blaming opponents and damning up dubious foe? Is it for show, all the right-wing parrots? Where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong? Ah, look at all the angry people. Ah, look at all the Ambassador Bolton hates the UN, but now he is a part of it all. He's got some gall, push the divider, renominates rival judges, no change in his tone. And he's not alone, all the angry people, where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong?
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and that is John Clark singing All the Angry People. Angry People to the tune of, as you heard it, Eleanor Rigby. That's an Andy Finn Show production. So today's April 14th, tomorrow's tax day, and today is also the birthday of Rod Steiger, among other people. Now, some of you who are young may not remember Rod, but he's an actor. And also the birthday of Frank Serpico. Not an actor, but Serpico, of course, was the title of a movie made about, it's a cop dealing with the mob, ultimately. And it's also the birthday of Pete Rose, the player who's most qualified for the Hall of Fame, who's not in the Hall of Fame, and who probably will never be in the Hall of Fame. He bet on gambling. There's a lot of people want Pete Rose to be forgiven and let in the Hall of Fame. They may forget what happened, but basically, while he was manager of the Cincinnati Reds, his gambling problem was so bad he bet on baseball. He even bet on his own team. Now, he bet on to win. He wasn't throwing games. But the cardinal rule in baseball is no gambling and no associating with gambling, and that's been true since the 1919 Black Sox scandal. And over every clubhouse that Pete Rose walked into as a player hung a sign that had the rule on it about gambling. You cannot associate with gamblers. And when he was caught and confronted with the evidence, he denied it all, and he denied it for 15 or 20 years, and it's cost him his place in the Hall. He's now come clean, but he signed a lifetime ban with Bart Giamatti, who was briefly commissioner of baseball and then died, and we don't have a commissioner anymore. We've got a guy who says he's the commissioner, but he's one of the owners. So the game of baseball is not in great hands, but that's the way it goes. Anyway, let me move on to the controversy over Barack Obama. And basically, here's the short version before we listen to the first of the clips about Obama. And basically, Obama was heard. There's an audio recording making the rounds right now of Obama. And what Obama's doing is talking in San Francisco in a closed session, meaning it was a fundraiser or something, about the voters of Pennsylvania and the frustration that people feel. And so he's being accused of being elitist and out of touch because he said people in Pennsylvania were bitter. And then he went on to say they're bitter, and so they vote on one-issue things. They vote on guns, or they vote on abortion, or they et cetera, et cetera. So let's just listen to Barack, and then we'll talk about the firestorm that's semi-firestorm that's arisen. Some say a tempest in a teapot. We'll see.
When you go into some of these small towns in Pennsylvania, like a lot of small towns in the Midwest, the jobs have been gone now for 25 years and nothing's replaced them.
So that's him saying the jobs have been gone for 25 years in these small towns in Pennsylvania, rural Pennsylvania, and in the Midwest. They've been gone for 25 years and nothing has replaced them.
And they've gone through the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, and each successive administration has said that somehow these communities are going to regenerate, and they have not.
So he's slamming Hillary here by saying we've been through the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. So at least 16 years, and if you go to the previous Bush administration, we're talking last 20 years, and even said 25 years, going back to Reagan, essentially, that everybody's promised these would be regenerated, and they have not. Well, of course, they aren't going to be regenerated. John McCain pointed that out when he went to I guess it was Detroit or someplace in Michigan. Basically, as Bruce Springsteen said in This Is My Hometown, these jobs have gone, and they ain't coming back. Here's Obama.
So it's not surprising, then, that they get bitter and they cling to guns.
So it's not surprising, then, that they're bitter. They get bitter and they cling to guns or
religion or antipathy towards people who aren't like them.
or religion or antipathy towards people who are not like them. This is the part that gets him in trouble.
Anti-immigrant sentiment or, you know, anti-trade sentiment.
Anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment.
A way to explain their frustration.
As a way to explain or express their frustration. I forgot what he said exactly. So this is what's so controversial, and it's the word bitter. And so both McCain and Hillary Clinton have picked up on this, and Hillary's attitude is basically that I wouldn't describe the people as bitter. I think they're resilient, and I wouldn't say that they take refuge in their religion, or I forget how he put it, that people of faith take pride or whatever she said. You know, they rejoice in their religion. It's not a matter of what did he say? He didn't say turn to their religion. I've already forgotten the exact quote. But basically, Obama has apologized and said, hey, I didn't say it very artfully, but I stand by the sentiment that people are, I come into town and say, I'm going to do something for you, and I'm not surprised people don't believe me. They're bitter because they've been promised things before. Now, will this hurt him? What's interesting is that both Republicans, including McCain, and Hillary are trying to paint Obama here as an elitist. The idea is that here he is from the bigger cities, Chicago, Harvard grad, you know, got things pretty good in general in life. He's an elitist because he's speaking about people in small towns as if they don't understand. That's what they're saying he was doing, and that he's out of touch. Well, he struck right back, and that's one of the things you got to admire about Obama, is he doesn't take it lying down. He strikes right back. And so what they've done, what he's done is said, look, I'm out of touch. John McCain and Hillary have been in Washington for decades. If anybody's out of touch, it's them. I know what's going on in middle America and on the street. So he's fighting right back. Now, what's interesting about the elitist argument also is I'm not sure how this sticks in that it's true Obama's Harvard Law, and he and his wife have it pretty well. They're both Harvard Law grads. But let's keep in mind that the Clintons just released their tax returns. They made $109 million in the last seven years. Now, that's fine. I don't begrudge them the money. But Obama, I don't know if they're millionaires now yet, he and his wife, but he certainly hasn't amassed a fortune yet. So it's interesting that the person who's rich calls Obama the elitist. The other piece of it is that McCain is also wealthy. He married his wealth. It'll be interesting to see if people try and do to John McCain what the Republicans did to John Kerry, which is accuse him of marrying his wife for the money. Right? They basically tried to emasculate Kerry by saying, well, you know, he married this woman with all this money. McCain's wife has, I don't know if she's got $400 million or $450 million, whatever it is, but he married into money himself. He married into a woman who's an heiress. So if there's anything elitist, it's Clinton and McCain are in more elite company, I would say. Now, you could argue that being elite is a state of mind. It's an attitude. And, of course, that's what people like Sean Hannity have done. I was flipping on the beginning of Hannity and Combs tonight before I came in, or as I was coming in, and Karl Rove is on explaining that Obama is an elitist, not that he's being painted as it, but no, he is actually an elitist. He is actually an ultra-liberal, and so, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, let's not forget that when Obama finished Harvard Law, he could have gone to a high-powered law firm in Washington or New York or somewhere else, and he chose to go back onto the streets of Chicago and work as an activist. So he's a little bit more in touch with the people than McCain or Hillary have been in recent years. But this issue's been a problem for him. So in particular, people are tying it to the Reverend Wright comment and saying, oh, it shows he's out of touch, it shows he's an elitist, it shows whatever. What I want to play now is a second clip where Obama clarifies his position on this. So this was a few days later where he was asked about it, and where he knew it was a flap, and in a rally he dealt with it.
When you go into some of these small towns in Pennsylvania, a lot of small towns in the Midwest, the jobs have been gone now for 25 years and nothing's replaced it. And they've gone through the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, and each successive administration has said that somehow these communities are going to regenerate, and they have not.
Okay, well, that's clearly the clip we were just listening to, so let's go on to the third clip, the right clip.
And Pennsylvania. People have been beaten down for so long, and they feel so betrayed by government, that when they hear a pitch that is premised on not being cynical about government, there's a part of them that just doesn't buy it.
So he's basically saying that people have been beaten down so long, they've heard so much promises from government, when they hear a pitch that says don't be cynical about government, like from Obama, they just don't buy it. Not a bad explanation of where he's coming from so far. Let's see what else this boy has to say. And by the way, that's a reference to a Republican lawmaker today, news came out today that a Republican lawmaker criticized Obama, says he's not ready to be commander-in-chief because he was in some kind of a high top-secret congressional simulation with him, but he had to refer to him as that boy is not ready, or something like that. Not smart. Here's Barack again finishing up his explanation of his original comments about why people are bitter.
And when it's delivered, now it is true that when it's delivered by a 46-year-old black guy named Barack Obama, then that adds another layer of skepticism.
So self-effacing humor always works well, and he's very good at it. He basically says when the message, don't be cynical, is delivered by a 46-year-old black guy named Barack Obama, there's going to be skepticism. Good one, Barack. Well, I thought there was more there, but I guess that's it on that clip. Anyway, let me go right on to the next clip. And this is Barack Obama on the Charlie Rose Show. It turns out that he made an appearance in 2004 on the Charlie Rose Show and discussed these very issues in a not in a stump speech, but sitting across from Charlie Rose. And so they're both talking about this issue of voters, disaffected voters, rural voters, and what their hot button issues are, or what they vote on, and whether they vote their own economic interest or they vote on some other issue like guns or religion or gays or whatever it is. And so the date of this is 2004. I guess this was right before he was elected to the Senate, maybe. And this was November. No, it was right after he was elected to the Senate before he took office, because it was November 23rd, my son Joel's birthday. No, I'm sorry. Joel's is October 23rd. Andy's is November 24th. So a day away from Andy's birthday. And this is Barack on the Charlie Rose Show, November 23rd, 2004.
But I think that we as a party are going to have to think about our overarching narrative, and we're also going to have to make sure that when we engage people, we engage them where they live and where they experience it. They're not thinking about 10-point policy plans. They are not thinking about the intricacies of the Medicaid, B-plus, provision, and they're not thinking about North Korea. What they're thinking about is how do I advance my life prospects? How do I make sure that my child
is... But they seem to, there's a book about what's wrong with Kansas,
right,
as you know.
Right, and my mother's from Kansas, so the...
And basically the book argues that to people in hardship cases,
yeah,
people who have not gotten the best end of the American dream are voting on faith issues,
yeah,
and morality issues rather than on economic interest.
Well, I'm going to interrupt that right there, where he says they're voting on faith issues rather than economic issues. You know, they're dancing around this issue of the fact that religious conservatives vote with Republicans, even though Republicans may not have their economic interest at heart. That is, Republican policies tend to favor business communities, tend to favor corporations over individuals. Their policies do. Those kinds of things. But I'm going to cap that for a moment, and when we come back from the break, we're going to continue with Barack Obama on Charlie Rose.